Today I'm talking to the Liberal Democrat MP for Richmond Park and North Kingston, and also cabinet spokesperson for the party. Welcome back to Radio Jackie, Sarah. Wanted to ask you about the proposals to close Queen Mary's Hospital Roehampton, enhance primary care hub. It provides essential local care. You've sent a joint letter to the government along with Paul Kohler. What would the closure mean for patients and your constituents?
Well, my constituents, myself, were really concerned here about the potential plans for closure, because what that would mean for people living locally is that where you've got, a non-major ailment, you're having to force to attend A&E instead, which, as we all know, already, very much, under pressure, or alternatively wait for a GP appointment, which might not be a feasible option if it's something that needs to be seen urgently. Or, people would be tempted with the lack of kind of urgent treatment that's easily available, just to ignore, whatever condition it is they're suffering from. And if it's an urgent, a serious injury rather, then that could obviously have very major implications. So I'm really concerned at the possibility of taking away this facility. I know from speaking to constituents how much they value it. So I'm really, really keen to engage with, the managing director of St George's University Hospital Trust, who runs it, and I've also written to Wes Streeting, the health secretary, just to try and engage them on the possible implications of any closure.
Yeah, it sort of goes against what he was saying recently about opening all these 100 new wonderful NHS hubs, so people can get treatment sort of 24/7, 7 days a week. Yet they're thinking of closing this, which is in effect a hub.
Exactly. It's precisely the opposite, A, of what we need, and B, what the government are kind of promising to deliver. I mean, it's part of decision making that's being made locally, and I think that's right, because it's important to make sure that when decisions about healthcare funding are made, they reflect local conditions. But at the same time, it doesn't make any sense at all to get rid of this very popular, very well used local facility that has got an extremely important role to play in local healthcare.
Are they citing that it's dilapidated, it's in poor condition, it needs money spent on it? Is that the reason they're thinking of closing it?
I think it's more to do with usage. Obviously all sites are expensive to operate, and there's a thought that perhaps they don't need the expense of operating that site when there's other sites like St George's Hospital not far away. But I think it sort of overlooks how difficult St George's can be to travel to for some people, but also the value of having an additional service that's located away from A&E, so that people aren't being diverted into that staff aren't being diverted away from that treatment centre to attend to A&E, and a separate site that people can feel confident using. So a lot of it obviously comes down to money at the end of the day, but I'm just hoping to be able to make the case that actually this is a good use of money, and that this is an efficient way of responding to people's healthcare needs.
Let's go on to police front desk. Sadiq Khan's plan, 2025 to 29, is going to result in closure of police front desk. I guess this is, as far as he's concerned, a cost-saving operation, but it's counterproductive, isn't it?
Well, I think it is, yes. Yeah. So they're planning to close the police front counter in Twickenham Police Station, which means there'll be no longer any police counters in the borough of Richmond. We already lost ours in central Richmond about a decade ago, I think. I mean, effectively, I mean the Met's argument for doing it is that the majority of crimes are now reported online or over the phone. And it's not people coming into police stations to report. But I think that kind of overlooks the broader value of having a police front counter in a community. It's knowing that the police are there, that the police are accessible, that you can go and speak to the police, not just to report a crime, but about, just raise your concerns, about particular areas of antisocial behaviour, perhaps, or something going on with a neighbour. And it's just a really, really important demonstration that the police are at the heart of the community, and people want to be able to feel that visible police presence, even if they don't need to call upon them, at any particular time or for months, years at a time. And let's very much hope that they don't. Knowing that they're there is a core part of what helps people feel safe in their community. So I think it's really, really important that we try and maintain that police counter presence wherever we can. But it's it was a key commitment from the mayor. Let's not forget that maintaining a 24/7 counter in every borough, that's what he said he was going to do. But under these new plans, only 8 boroughs are going to have a 24/7 counter. So that's a real breaking of promises from the mayor. And when he made that promise, he recognized the value of it. And now all of a sudden he's gone back on his word and he's pretending it doesn't matter anymore. And I think people all over London will feel very let down by that.
I think police are relying too much on assuming that everybody's digital and everybody can go online, and it excludes a lot of people, doesn't it?
Indeed, and we're seeing this sort of more and more, really, that we don't need to provide a presence in high streets because everyone's doing things online. We've seen this with banks. We saw this a couple of years ago with railway station ticket offices, and I think actually it's leading to people sort of feeling isolated because they don't have that sort of human interaction now that they used to have as a matter of course on any number of points throughout the day. It just increasingly makes people feel anxious as well because they don't know who to speak to if they've got a problem and they don't know who to talk to about it. Going online is not always a substitute for that. So I think it is. It's a sort of an increasing feature, if you like, replacing people with machines. And I do think, while obviously there are in some cases there, it's more efficient and it's easier and it's easy for people to adapt to. I think there are certain things where it is really important that we maintain that human contact and police station front counters is very much one of those.
Yeah, let's go on to the rise in employers' national insurance contributions. I know you've asked the government to have another look at this because it's really hitting the hospitality sector hugely. There's a rise in energy costs. There's all sorts of things that are really making people flinch at how they're going to run their businesses. What sort of luck have you had with sort of getting the government to listen?
Well, we'll keep making the point. Obviously, we're expecting the budget on November the 26th, and I think one of the things that Rachel Reeves is hearing very loud and clear from the Liberal Democrats and from others is that the increase in employers' national insurance has been a real blow for employers across every sector. But we're seeing a real impact, particularly in the hospitality sector, because the combination of the increase in the rate and also the lowering of the threshold at which national insurance contributions need to be start being paid hits hardest on those industries that are employing lots of people on part-time contracts and on low wages. And it's things like cafes, bars, restaurants, tourist destinations, that sort of thing. That's the sort of employment that they offer. And so there's been a huge, for them, the increase in national insurance has been proportionately much higher than it has been for other sectors. So, but also the hospitality sector is having to deal with big increases in the last few years on its energy bills. They're also seeing big hikes in business rates because some of the business rate discounts they got during COVID have started to fall away. They're just seeing lots and lots of pressures from all sorts of different directions. And that's why we're calling for the government to reverse its national insurance increase for the hospitality sector in particular, but also because it's having such a negative impact on employment, and particularly that kind of employment, as I was saying, in the hospitality sector for young people, for the people on low wages who are unskilled, those kind of entry level jobs, those first steps on the rung to a career, or where people can just earn a bit of extra money to kind of boost their household income. It's those jobs that are being most threatened, and those jobs that really make the most difference, both to young people and to people on low incomes.
Are they also being hit by the changes in employment law about day one when you're employed? That must be having an effect as well. So it's a triple, quadruple whammy, isn't it?
Indeed, I'll be speaking on the Employment Rights Bill later this afternoon, actually, Jackie. We're considering the Lords Amendments, and indeed, the Day One rights is something that a lot of businesses have been speaking to me about and saying they're really, really concerned about that. Basically, from the government's proposal is that from the first day of employment, a new employee will have the right to take an employer to court for unfair dismissal. The Liberal Democrats are arguing that the current length of 2 years before someone can claim unfair dismissal is too long, but we would like to see 6 months because there's plenty of reasons why, in all good faith, an employer might make a mistake about who they're hiring. They might not have fully thought about, the skills that somebody needs to do the job. They might not, they might have made a mistake about this particular person not being the right person to do the job. And those employers who are taking on people for the first time because they're growing their business are obviously more prone to making those kind of mistakes than more experienced hirers. So we worry that day one rights is going to really deter people from creating new employment because they don't want to get caught up in the possibility of an employment tribunal, which is obviously something that employers worry a huge amount about.
Yeah, that's more expensive for them. Let's stay with the Lords. I know that the end of life bill has been going through the Lords. Have you had any more on that as to where they're going?
No. No, I'm following that quite carefully because we did a lot on terminally ill adults in the Commons. I thought they had the first session of the second reading debate last Friday, and the next one is next Friday. And I think there's close to 200 Lords who want to speak in the debate, which really does show how engaged people are in the issue, but also how many different points of view there are on this, and how strongly people feel. There was a very good speech, I thought, by Lady May, obviously former Prime Minister, about this. But I think what we see is everybody is looking at this with a great deal of seriousness, a great deal of care. It's a huge step that we would be taking as a country. My personal belief, and just to be clear, this is a conscience issue, so I'm not speaking on behalf of the Liberal Democrats here. But my personal belief is that the bill as it's currently drafted does not provide the kind of safeguards that we need to see in order to really protect people. But I'll be interested to see if the Lords want to make amendments that they'll then pass back to the Commons for us to vote on in future. So paying close attention to what's going on.
Okay. And lastly, still in the Lords, hereditary peerages. Do you think they still should exist in this modern world of ours?
Absolutely not. And the government introduced legislation last year, which has finally come back to the Commons, to abolish hereditary peers. And the Liberal Democrats, position on this is very, very clear. Hereditary peers have no place in a modern legislature. Ideally, what we'd like to see is a fully elected House of Lords. I think that's going to be some distance away in our future. But there is absolutely no excuse for people inheriting their right to make laws on behalf of everybody else. And I spoke out very strongly in support of scrapping hereditary peers when it came to the Commons a couple of weeks ago. And this is something that the Liberal Democrats feel very strongly and passionately about. And I will be doing everything I can to help the government push this legislation through because it's high time we scrapped hereditary peers from our legislature.
Well, we'll keep an eye on that one. Let's go on to Heathrow expansion. What are your main concerns? There's various options on the table. There's the Aurora one, which is extending the runway, and then there's a big one at 49 billion, which means building a new runway under the M25 and all the things that go with that. What are your feelings about how this should go?
It's extraordinary. I mean, I think it probably goes without saying I'm opposed to any expansion of Heathrow. The number of flights already going over my constituency already creates significant disadvantage to my constituents in terms of the health impacts, the noise, the pollution, the traffic congestion of people going to and from the airport. So I remain completely opposed to any kind of expansion. I think it's impossible to expand Heathrow Airport, any airport. And remain within the government's climate commitments. And I think that's something that they need to take very seriously and take due account of. But I think they also think also the question remains about how to finance this expansion. Heathrow Airport Limited, the company that owns Heathrow Airport, already in a significant amount of debt. So in order to raise the money to pay for this expansion, they would be paying, quite high rates of interest on any money that they borrowed, and that's all going to come back to the airlines, to the people who are buying flights, to fund that expansion. So, my constituents would be funding the expansion and dealing with the noise, and it's not wanted or needed. And I think we need to see, much more detail from the government about what the economic impact of an expanded Heathrow will be, because I simply cannot see how the environmental damage and the expense could ever be outweighed by the any contribution to economic growth. It doesn't seem feasible to me. So I am looking at developments with interest, but I will continue to fight very hard against any form of expansion.
Good. Lastly, you have your work experience program open for Richmond Park students.
Yes, that's right. Yes, I do this every year. So the October half term, we are Parliament sits throughout the year. We pretty much sort of match up with school holidays, except for the October half term, and students are off, and we're still sitting. So I use the opportunity to invite some normally year 12 students into my office, both in Parliament and my constituency office in Mortlake, and give them the opportunity both to have a look around, see what it's like, see what an MP does, but also to try some things out for themselves. So I'll get them to sort of draft some questions or speeches, to do maybe a social media post, do a clip a video, write a bit of my newsletter to constituents, help me with my correspondence. So they get an opportunity to do lots of different things like that, as well as, watching some of the business in the chamber, or having a look around Parliament. So I offer it every year. It's been a huge success. I'm always particularly interested to hear from year 12 students who have a passion for politics, who live in the Richmond Park constituency. And if they want to get in touch with me, drop me an email, or find me on my website, then I really want to hear from them.
Yeah. It's a good thing you're doing. How important do you think it is to now teach our youngsters about politics? There's a move to move the voting age to 16. They need to know who and what they're voting for, don't they? And to understand the process.
They do, and I think I'd love to see a more widespread, boost to politics education generally. And I think particularly important because there's so much misinformation online now, and there is so much, I guess, rhetoric being pushed at young people. And I think they need to be able to have the skills that will stand back, and form a view about it. What are they being told? Who's telling it to them? What are the interests of that person? So I think that more kind of like, upskill them to take a critical view of some of the things that they're being told online. But also, you're absolutely right. I'm very supportive of votes at 16. And one of the reasons I am is because there'll be more young people be casting their first vote while they're still at school. And I think that'd be an excellent opportunity for them to walk through the steps. What does voting mean? What does it do? Who are you voting for? What do they stand for? How does the voting system work? But even then, some of those practical things about, you'll get your polling card through the post, and on a certain day at a certain time, you need to take it to a. Honestly, the way we vote is so archaic. It's not surprising that for young people who are used to doing things online at the touch of at the click of a button, that it's kind of like this. It is very, very old fashioned. So, where is your polling station? What time is it open? Do you need to take your polling card? What does your ballot paper look like? What do you do with it? How many people can you vote for? Let's take the opportunity to walk young people through those really, really what seems like to experienced voters like ourselves. They seem like obvious things, but let's walk them through that process so that it doesn't feel intimidating and they can get into the habit of voting from a very early age.
Yes, it does worry me that they're getting all that information off social media because they have no idea of the source in social media. If they're getting information about politics, maybe even if they can't introduce it into national curriculums for more schools to have politics clubs. I went to a school recently, a primary school. They had their own pupil parliament and they learned how to vote and they had ministers for this, that, and the other. It was brilliant. And I'm thinking, why can't more schools just have a politics club?
That is absolutely excellent. And I think when I'm out and about and I'm speaking to young people, they are really interested. They really want to understand how the world around them operates and how to have influence. And I think one of the things that we really need to teach is, how to campaign for change. If you're not happy with the government's sort of policies on climate change, which is a huge
Yeah.
issue for young people, what can you do to encourage them to do things differently? How do you communicate with your MP? What can your MP do for you? But also, what other groups exist that are pushing for change, and how can you contribute to those? So I think it's really, really important, because I think otherwise there's a bit of a danger that young people feel disenfranchised. They feel like there isn't a way of pushing for the change that they want to see. And we just need to we need to empower them.
We do indeed. Right, so I think we've covered quite a lot of topics and there's always more to cover next time. So I will let you go, but thank you once again for coming on to Radio Jackie.
Not at all. Always a pleasure to speak to you. Thanks for having me.
That's a pleasure too. Thank you very much.